The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation. Good afternoon and welcome back to the Sunday Scotch Society. My name is Kyle Quincy. And there's a bunch of other stuff in the middle there, Parker. And I know that you who have joined us are excited about the journey that we're taking into the realm of malted barley and all of the wonderful things that surround it, including spring water and peat moss and all of these other wonderful things, the oak barrels and the sherry and the different elements that come together to create the dram that we are so excited about here on the Sunday Scotch Society. As usual, I'm excited to have my partner in crime with me, and I will now cease talking so that he may do the thing that he usually does.
Good afternoon, dear listener.
You might tell them, even though they know, who you are.
Yes, I am and remain Matthew Kelly, your indomitable co-host.
Indeed, indeed. And as is usual here on the Sunday Scotch Society, today we will be engaging in interesting and fascinating conversation. Usually we are together when we record, but today we have a special circumstance. And as such, that means that we are not necessarily sharing the same dram as we would usually be doing. Today, I am incredibly excited to find out what you're drinking, Matthew. And then I can tell you what I'm drinking and we can introduce our very special guest and find out what they're drinking, and then we can do the thing.
Yes, so I have the Aberfeldy 12. It is a single malt scotch from the Highlands, and I am quite looking forward to that noise.
Yes, yes, indeed. The infamous noise. I myself am drinking the Glenrothes 12 from the Solera line of the Glenrothes scotches. What that means is it's aged in sherry oak, and it is, I confess that we have sipped this dram on the show once before, and I could not wait to sip it again. And I thought that given the provenance of this particular scotch, and given our guest today, and his associations, I thought this would be an appropriate scotch to drink in the company of one Reed Parker, who I will describe as the Macallan Scotch expert for the Caribbean and Latin American region. That might be giving him more territory than he would claim for himself. But I've known Reed for a short while now, and he is a brilliant and incredibly knowledgeable and very engaging Scotch professional. And I'm really excited to have him join us today on the Sunday Scotch Society. Reed Parker, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. That's quite a warm welcome. Happy to be here. Myself, I am drinking the Macallan Sherry Oak 18 today. It's definitely not my everyday dram, but today being on the show, I figured it was a good occasion to treat myself.
I agree. That's why I'm drinking the Glenrothes. It's not one that I can afford to drink every day, but you know, since special occasions and all that, you know?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Reed, would you, to get us started before we take the first sip, which is our usual tradition, would you tell us a little bit about your work experience and who you are, just so that folks get a sense of who you are as we begin the conversation?
Yeah, I'd love to. Work experience, you know, I've been in the industry since I was 13, and I was dishwashing at a golf course so I could pay for my membership. And, you know, I worked in the kitchen for quite a while, actually, up until about 21. And I loved it back there. I loved the creative side to it. I loved the flavors. I loved piecing dishes together. And it wasn't until the front of house ended up being short one day. And they said, "Hey, Reed, you're a good looking guy. Come out here." And I remember being in front of the bar. Of course, I was scared, but there was just this adrenaline rush. And I remember at the end of it, I couldn't have been happier. And I think that was my last shift in the kitchen. Ever since then, I've been front of house. Throughout my career, I've done a lot behind the bar, a little bit in front as well. I've done a lot of management, part owner as well. But my overall love and passion is for spirits, all spirits as well. Yes, I do represent the Macallan, but I love all spirits. I love the industry as a whole. I love the, everything from, you know, the busser to the server to the bartender. This is my passion, and I couldn't imagine being in anything else.
Excellent. And, I don't want to speak out of turn, but the company that you work for right now is Edrington.
That's correct. Yeah.
I've said a bit about Edrington on the show over the last couple of weeks, but could you just tell us a little bit about Edrington and your role in the company?
Yeah, absolutely. So Edrington has a pretty awesome portfolio. Scotch is the main focus. We have the Macallan, the Naked Malt, Famous Grouse, Glen Ross, Highland Park. We have a few others as well. We have Wyoming Whiskey, which is a fantastic new dram. I can't say enough about it. If you like a really good bourbon, I can't say enough about it. We also have Number 3 Gin, Brugal Rum. So we have quite an extensive portfolio. The company itself is phenomenal. I honestly can't say that I've ever worked for such a good company. They really take care of their employees. I feel like I'm part of their family, so I'm really appreciative for my role with them. What I do in particular is I am the Caribbean brand specialist for the Macallan. I do cover the other portfolios, but I am majority Macallan. Essentially, I go around, I enhance the education, I make sure there's good brand presence for the Macallan. I host a lot of events, and I get to drink whiskey in hot weather around the Caribbean. It's a tough life.
But somebody's got to do it, right?
I've got to be that guy, you know? Somebody's got to do it, you're right.
Yeah. So the tradition on the show, Reed, is that after the introductions, we take our first sip. So I'm going to uncork my bottle of Glen Ross, and Matthew will do his wonderful Aberfeldy, and I encourage you to open up that gorgeous Sherry Oak 18.
Oh, I'd love to.
Yeah, so here we go.
The color is just beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
So you have already begun how we usually do it. So tell us about the experience of having poured the Macallan Sherry Oak 18.
Well, you know, the first thing that I always look at is the legs and essentially the natural oils that the whiskey brings. And Macallan is just so well known for their extensive, beautiful velvet oils. Essentially, we get that from the small stills that we use. We use some of, if not the smallest stills in Scotland. And the reason why we do that is to enhance this natural oil. It does a lot of things. It not only coats and protects your mouth, it also helps us withstand the time in the barrels as well. I mean, we just released a 82-year-old whiskey, and that's pretty amazing when you think about it, because that's a lot of time in wood, and these natural oils help preserve the whiskey. So that's the first thing that I always look at. Of course, next, I look at the color. For me, I see this beautiful red, almost mahogany. And it's very clean. It's a very clean whiskey. There's certainly no faults that I can see. When I come in, do you want me to go on the nose as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the natural next step, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing that I love to do is I just want to wake up my nose. I don't really dive into it looking for certain characters. I just want to kind of stretch up my nose. Once I have done that, I kind of dive in there for a second time. I'm looking for essentially what the Macallan stands for, those really nice dried fruits. The sherry cask, of course, I don't like to use personal references when I do my tastings, but I think everybody knows what a fresh oatmeal raisin cookie is. I get a lot of that. I definitely get some ginger, and of course that beautiful mature oak.
Yeah, it's having had the Macallan Sherry Oak 18, I agree with your description of the nose. Certainly, for me, if I'm casting my mind back accurately, as you say, you know, personal descriptors are personal, but I also remember getting almost an almond kind of nuttiness in the nose. Yep. As well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I could definitely see that. I could also say maybe a little bit of dark chocolate. Yeah. And you know, every nose is different. It's of course the key notes are always going to be there for everybody, but mm-hmm. everybody's going to pick up, you know, a thing here or there. Something that kind of sits well with them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, with the Glenross 12, the overwhelming first sort of sense that I get is it's almost vanilla and strangely not watermelon, but a different kind of, some kind of a, almost a fruity melony flavor as well. And then there's the sherry, and a little bit I don't want to say, are you familiar with treacle? The, you know, the Irish fruitcake type thing. It's a British fruitcake that has a bunch of different fruits mixed together with brown sugar and some other yeah. Ingredients. And I think that's kind of the overall sense that I get from the nose of the Glenross 12. It's one of the most bewitching aromas that I've had in a good scotch.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Matthew?
Well, getting a bit of cinnamon. Not much citrus there. And I think also maybe not nutty, maybe a little more woody. Like a soft, freshly shaved wood, maybe.
Interesting.
That's all I got for now.
Yeah. And of course, as it opens up in the, I'm presuming that you are using those tulip glasses that you have. So as it opens up, I'm sure that the nose and the aromas will mature as we taste and so on and so forth. The next step, of course, is the most important when it comes to scotch, and that's sipping. Now, as a professional, somebody who drinks scotch for a living, and I'm telling you that is an enviable job. What do you have to teach us or tell us or guide us? What guidance do you have to give us on sipping a scotch?
Absolutely. Just like I said, how I'm stretching up my nose, I want to warm up my mouth as well. And by doing so, I take a really small sip, and I just let it coat my mouth. I'm not saying swirl by any means, but I just let the natural oils kind of coat my mouth, almost protect it. And then once I do that, I'm not exactly diving into it, looking for certain characters. I am just, I guess, gearing up my mouth for diving into a delicious dram. For the Macallan 18, it is very, very friendly. Very, very friendly. These natural oils in here are just velvety smooth. I've already had a sip, and, 30 seconds after having that sip, I'm talking to you, and I'm still tasting these beautiful, beautiful notes of mature oak. Definitely raisins, sultans. I would say like a ginger syrup, and almost like a Christmas cake as well. Just those beautiful baking spices with those dried fruits, and of course the amazing barley that they use. Everything is just, it's a marriage. It's a marriage between all of these beautiful notes, and it comes together so well. It's truly a remarkable dram.
Yeah. The Glenross gives me candy. But not sweet candy, and not overly sweet anyway. I mean, there's a hint of sweetness to it. You talk about the natural oils, they're certainly coating the tongue and guide it. It almost feels like there's a layer guiding the scotch down the esophagus and whatever else. You get that warm blossoming going through the lungs and that kind of feeling, right? But
yeah,
in terms of taste, there's vanilla, there's that certainly came through from the nose, and it, as you drink, as I am drinking it, that aroma is echoed in the flavor, as is the melon, a little cinnamon, a little, like I say, that treacle, the fruitcake type flavors. Those are definitely there. On the tongue, there's also sort of a butteriness. I don't know how else to describe it, but that's something that I usually associate more with bourbon. But there's definitely a butteriness here with the Glenross 12 for sure.
Beautiful. One thing that I really like about Glenross is that they stay true to tradition. They are also in the rare majority that don't add any coloring to their whiskey. They get everything just from those beautiful barrels. And, I always look at that kind of stuff as organic.
Matthew, I as a fan of the Aberfeldy 12, I cannot wait to hear your description, especially given that the first time we tasted it together was quite some time ago. So I'm curious to see how your experience of it in the mouth is different now than it was way back then.
Yeah, so it comes in with that cinnamon, almost cinnamon candy, but not in a bad way. Feel with that delightful, for lack of a better word, burn. But no butteriness here. I'm not sure if that's something that you experienced or not. But something that stands out to me that is kind of surprises, very pleasant grass. And this bit, I don't know if that's anything that you've experienced, but it's certainly a pleasant surprise to me. Mm-hmm. Overall, the flavors are a bit sharper and cleaner than something like a bourbon, I think.
There you go. I don't remember grass, but mm-hmm. As Reed is saying, every taste is different. So I'll have to go find my own bottle of the Aberfeldy 12 when this is done and sip it to see if there's any grass in there for me. Yeah. Reed, there's some similarities between the way we've all described these single malts. And I think that is one of the areas of not quite difficulty that some people have with this particular drink, but it is cause, I think, for some hesitation sometimes, right? People don't know what it is they're supposed to be tasting or how one scotch is different from another. And so I kind of want to get into the difference in scotches, particularly single malts today, with you just a little bit. I know, for instance, that the Aberfeldy is the personal distillery of the Dewar, John Dewar, if I remember correctly.
That is correct, yeah.
That's his hometown, is that right, I think?
Yeah, in the Highland.
Yeah. So Aberfeldy is a Highland Scotch. Glenrothes is a Speyside. And so, you know, these are different areas in Scotland where the Scotch is produced. And in wine, we talk about terroir, where, you know, the earth that the grapes are planted in and matured in, and the nature around them, whether that's sunshine, whether that's rainfall, whether that's wind conditions, whatever, even elevation, right, make such a difference in the taste and quality of the wine. And I wonder if that is similar or true at all in the Scotch world.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely it is. The water you use is the biggest factor. You know, Macallan being on the Spey, it's amazing we have this beautiful natural spring water. I think that's a huge factor to the success that we've had. But everywhere that you go, regardless of the region, even if you're just going down the road, it's going to be a completely different Scotch. Everything that you mentioned has big factors, just like it does in wine. It does in Scotch as well.
So is it as a one of the things that people who are talking to me after they listen to the show, one of the things they talk about is wanting to develop not expertise but knowledge on how to really appreciate fine scotches. My view is you just drink them, right? Because at the end of the day, it's a drink. It's something that you're supposed to put in your mouth and enjoy one way or the other, right? But Scotch has such a defined culture around it. And I guess I want to ask, and Matthew, I'm sure you have your own questions, but my first proper question for the show is, where does this culture of Scotch come from in your experience, in your view?
Well, you know, it goes back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, the term aquavita is essentially based around Scotch. It has gone through tyrannic kings. You know, you look at the names with Glen in it, and most people don't know that they have the word Glen in it because they were actually producing glens and covered, so they were actually able to hide their distilleries from tyrannic kings. Scotland's gone through numerous wars, numerous hardships, and I truly believe that if it wasn't for the desire to create good products, Scotch would have been, it wouldn't be here today. And it's a series of hard decisions, and I think they made the right decision every time. During Prohibition, everybody was affected. Scotland, extremely, extremely affected. Macallan especially. I mean, us back in the day, like before, I'd say around like the 1870s, 80s, we were based on blended. You know, we would give our products to the distilleries around us. And it wasn't until about 1826, when times were really tough, that a beautiful person decided to keep some family barrels, and we decided to start aging them and having private stock. And then you look at, you know, what that's done for us now, it's pretty amazing.
It seems like Scotch is a almost like a family business, right?
Absolutely. Back in the day, yes, absolutely it was.
And it's almost like, like how craft beers are, there's such a culture around protecting the brew, protecting the recipe, protecting the ingredients. I won't tell you what hops I use, and even if you know what hops I use, you don't know how I use them, et cetera, et cetera. In Scotch, everybody has, as you say, it's the spring water from the spey or whatever the case may be. But are there is there such a is there a competition almost in terms of protecting brew recipes?
I wouldn't say so. I think some of the smaller distilleries maybe a little bit, but the big distilleries were pretty open about what we do because it's all essentially the same methods, the same grains. There might be a difference in weights, stuff like that, but nobody is hiding what they're doing. In fact, we're not allowed to hide what we do. If you go to the Macallan Distillery, there's actually this beautiful thick glass around all of our stills, so everybody can just look in and see exactly how we do it. I mean, I think that the Scotch society is very close-knit. We all kind of have each other's backs. It's an amazing story. I mean, the first documented Scotch was back in 1494. That's pretty unbelievable, honestly.
1494. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's old. That's old. Yeah.
I know.
And I guess this goes back to my original question is for the drinker, especially someone who's a neophyte who's just trying to get into it. How do you tell the difference? And what and how do you tell whether the differences mean anything to you?
I think that all comes down to personal preference. You know, when it comes to Scotch, there's so many different avenues. You can do smoky, you can do peaty, you can do sherry casked. They're trying so many different casks right now, and all of it is super unique and super beautiful. So it's really what's, I guess, catching your heart. When it comes to, I guess, picking up certain notes and differences from distillery to distillery, that comes with time. The one thing that I did actually, I used to work at this amazing cocktail lounge called Veneto in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada. And there was four of us that reopened it, rebranded. None of the same staff stayed. And we went in there and we did an amazing job. We actually ended up winning Cocktail Bar of the Year from Yam Magazine in our first year. I was the new guy there. And I don't mean that as in when I started, but new to their level of expertise. And I remember having a dram with one of my colleagues, Ryan Simpson, one of my best friends now. I can't say enough about him. And I see him writing in this book, and I look at him, and I'm like, what are you writing down? And it's his, you could call it like his whiskey Bible or his flavor Bible. And essentially every whiskey that he tries, he's writing down notes, what he's getting, if he liked it. And it goes down to the nose, the palate, the appearance. And he would flip through his notes and he would compare the whiskeys. You know, if he feels like he's picking up a certain note, he would actually flip through his book and he was able to relate what he was tasting to a certain whiskey, whether it's in the same region or not, it was documented. So that was what I started to do. And every day I would pick a bottle off the back bar. I would learn about it. And then when I didn't have enough bottles on the back bar, I would pick one on the internet and I would learn about it, learn about it, learn about it until I had essentially an understanding of what the casks mean, the regions, the different types of oak. And I ended up, I guess, having such an appreciation for the craftsmanship and the characters that come with each scotch from each region. So I guess the advice that I would give is try whiskey from different regions, start there and document everything. Go through your documents, you know, pinpoint what these notes mean to you, and you can find your ideal whiskey eventually. And that is definitely my advice to anybody that wants to actually get into whiskey and have, I guess, more of an understanding to it.
True, true. Matthew, I apologize. I've been monopolizing the questioning. So I'll step aside.
I'm enjoying sitting back and just listening at this point. I do have one simple comment. In trying to learn more about whiskey and scotch in particular, I stumbled across a YouTuber called Ralphie, a Scottish guy who, you know, basically reviews whiskeys, a lot of small batch. But the pertinent thing is that he was describing how in his Father's Day, he would walk in, if he wanted something special, he would walk into a bar and, you know, they may give him a Walker or whatever and tell him this is what it is and he'd just have to accept it. But now there's just this access that the average man just didn't have before to all of these quality scotches. And I thought that that's, you know, very fascinating, very similar to how a craft beer industry has taken off as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, the internet is just nothing but knowledge on every dram that you can find. There's so many small distilleries opening up, and that's worldwide. That's not just Scotland. And I think it's all amazing. I know I already said it, but people are trying some really unique things, and a lot of it is just super unusual and very enticing to me, like very, very exciting for me, and I just want to try everything, honestly.
So I want to do a bit of service journalism here, right? There are some very basic sort of taste qualifiers that are associated with scotch. Things like a Highland scotch or a Speyside single malt or a heavily peated scotch, for instance.
Yeah.
So can you maybe take us through what these signifiers mean and how they should be interpreted as far as what they would taste like?
Yeah, every region has their own unique characters. You know, I can start off with the Highlands. I always think of them as very full, rich, I would say cereal. Definitely lighter, a little bit drier, fruitier. The Eastern Highlands are a little bit more fruity than the Western. They're all very easy to drink. When you think of Islay, you know, you think of the amazing peat and smoke. And I really do enjoy a good peaty dram. It's just, you have to be in the mood for it. If anybody hasn't had peat and they have something like a Lagavulin or an Auchtermore, it is very unique and you have to get it. You can't just jump into those big peaty scotches, or maybe you can, maybe that is what your palate is craving. Every region is just completely different. What else would you like me to describe? Can you give me the region?
We talked about, for instance, both the Macallan and the Glenrothes of Speyside whiskies, right? Well, that means that they are made along the Spey River.
That's correct.
And so you talked about Islay, you talked about the Talisker, for instance. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of different places where there are sort of Scotch experiences that are really super unique.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's go back to peat though, because I that was one that I really wanted to make sure that our listeners understand.
Yeah.
Peat is what exactly?
So peat is, sorry, one second. Peat is essentially, it's almost like a moss. It is a very earthy, I'm trying to think of the right word. Trying to think of the right word to describe peat.
I say dirt with smoke in it. but
it's very, very, very earthy. It is very intense and very, very strong. I used to work with a gentleman, and when somebody was asking what's peat like, even though that the flavor profiles are nothing alike, they said, you know, when you put wasabi on your sushi and it's that big blast of flavor, mm-hmm. that is essentially what peat is.
So how does it get into the scotch is what I'm asking.
Sorry, say it again.
Sorry. So yeah, how does the peat and that big peaty flavor get into the scotch?
It's actually burnt. So it's burnt underneath. So when you are doing your green malts, the peat is actually roasted underneath it.
Yeah. So something like the Octomore or as you say, the Lagavulin 16, which is a famously intense peaty scotch, right? That is what is happening as the barley is being malted, the peat is being burnt underneath.
That's correct.
And is it correct? My understanding is that burn is actually to stop the malting at a particular point.
Yes.
Which is going to affect the flavor profile.
Yeah. You could say it's like a smoky flavor. And it's essentially released by peat fires, and it's used to dry malted barley.
Mm-hmm. All right. So when I guess what I'm getting at is for the person who is looking at a bottle of scotch and it says peated scotch or heavily peated or lightly peated, what they're looking at is an indicator that this scotch has a very smoky flavor to a greater or lesser extent.
Yeah, absolutely. You could say smoky. I think that's a good way to break it down for somebody that's just getting into scotch. Of course, there is legitimately smoky scotches. Peat's a little bit more, as I said, earthy, mossy. I don't want to say dirty because that's not an appealing word. And I mean, peat is beautiful, but it's a very gritty smokiness.
Mm-hmm. I the first time I had a Lagavulin 16, I felt like it was almost medicinal, and I couldn't wrap my head around it. Honestly, I was like, "What the heck is this?"
Yeah,
and it's a blended Scotch, but the Peat Monster, the Compass Box Peat Monster, is something that I've forced Matthew to try, and I'll let Matthew talk about his experience with that.
Yeah, the Peat Monster is pretty beautiful. I really enjoy that one. I also enjoy the Octomore, the whole series actually. Those are big peat bombs, but they're just delicious.
Yeah. Matthew?
I'm working my way up there. My palate is not there yet.
Yeah, I get you, buddy. I get you. But you did enjoy the Port Charlotte though, didn't you?
Yes, that was very nice. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They're all so different, and it just takes a lot of time to experiment and contemplate. And you know, the Whiskey Taste Journal is a great idea. I think I'm gonna break out one of these notepads just for that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I still have mine actually throughout the years. And I every now and then I like to flip through it. And I can also see how much I've progressed. When I first started, it might have been a line or two. And now I can write a novel on what I'm, what I'm tasting, what I'm seeing, what I'm smelling. It's kind of cool to look back and reflect on that. And I heard you mention the Port Charlotte. I have to say, Brooklatic is one of my go-tos. The Dark Arts series is just phenomenal scotch.
Yeah, it is. It feels like a confession, but it makes such perfect sense for all of it to be in the same family. But like Edrington has like three of my all-time favorite scotches in its portfolio. The famous Grouse is maybe my favorite blended scotch of all time, especially the Smoky Black.
I was going to say, you probably like the Smoky Black, don't you?
Oh my God, yeah, I love the Smoky Black. The Highland Park Magnus is,
yep.
I think Matthew will agree with me. So one of the things that I used to do is at a place here in town called Crypto Isle. I would have Whiskey Wednesdays with a group of fellas and just have them come and try a whiskey and some cigars, right? And of all of the whiskeys that we tried at Whiskey Wednesday, I'm pretty sure that the Magnus by Highland Park was by far the best received of all of those scotches. Matthew, would you agree with that?
It's definitely top two. And I'm reaching for what the other one was. So by default, King.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And of course, you know, I, as a single malt drinker, the Macallan, I am a Macallan fan. And I kind of want to save the last couple of minutes of the show to talk about Macallan, but I didn't want to be overly biased with my Macallan fandom. Matthew, are you, before I jump in onto the Macallan, is there anything else you want to jump on?
No. Let's dive in.
Mm-hmm. Good. Oh, wait. I just had another sip of my Glenross. And as we've been talking and I've been sipping, the vanilla notes have kind of blossomed out into this is weird to me, but a much richer fruit, almost like a banana. You know, and it's just really, I love how it's developing as time goes.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just like wine, whiskey definitely does open up with some fresh air. And even adding a couple drops of water to any of your whiskey, there's nothing wrong with that. It brings in a completely different experience, if you ask me.
Yeah. Actually, before I jump in on Macallan, you raise a question that has caused horror in the minds of some of the people I know who are single malt drinkers, and that's this idea of cutting your single malt either with ice or with other other mixers. I had somebody the other day ask if they would mind if I mixed Macallan 12 with tonic water, and after I revived myself, I was like, for the purposes of this conversation, absolutely not. But the reality is, well, let me not say what the reality is. Let me ask a question instead. As the Scotch professional, what are your thoughts on mixing single malt Scotch?
You know, one of the things that I like to pride myself on is not essentially selling Macallan, but providing a Macallan experience. And if your Macallan experience means you want to put tonic water in your Macallan, then feel free. If that's how you're going to enjoy it, that's what we make it for. We make it to be enjoyed. Mind you, if we're opening up like a 1926 or something like that, that there's been, you know, a lot of history and effort and just blood, sweat, and tears into those drams, and you ask to mix it with tonic water, I might kindly mention it's probably not the best thing to do. But however you want to drink your whiskey, drink your whiskey. It's not up to me. I like to drink my whiskey neat. I always have, always will, up until about 47%, and then I'll maybe add in a drop here and there. But that's only to open up the dram. I've always looked at high ABV as almost salt, just like a chef would put salt into a dish. I think that little bit of heat is essentially there to balance out the dram. That being said, if it's a little bit too hot for your mouth, then you're not going to enjoy the dram. You don't have to be a hero thinking, oh, it's, you know, I shouldn't put water into this. You can actually help. You're helping yourself enjoy the dram. So if that's what you want to do, then by means, please do. As long as you're enjoying it, that's all, I think that's all a whiskey professional will care about. Just enjoy it.
Matthew?
And Kyle Quincy Parker will judge you silently in most cases.
Silently, but very, very, very harshly. Absolutely, yes.
I'm with Reed.
So the beautiful thing about the Macallan, in my view, is, well, one of the beautiful things about Macallan is the history and the sense of the historicity of the brand and how it is sort of woven into how the Scotch is sold. For instance, the Reach that sold for $2.7 million.
That was the Fine and Rare 1926.
Oh, right. Sorry. That, to me, you know, I have a number of friends who are, you know, either well off or on the way to well off. And the question was, why in the world would you spend $2.7 million on a bottle of whiskey?
Yeah. You know, it's a piece of art, first of all. Not only that, but it's a piece of our history. Back in 1926, I think I already mentioned a little bit, we were going through tough times, and the owner at the time, Nellie, who is Roderick Kemp's daughter, essentially Roderick Kemp was I don't want to say the only reason, but he's a big reason why we started doing seasoning our oak casks with sherry. His daughter took over the company when he passed away, and there she is with about seven other widows employed. All their husbands, unfortunately, didn't make it through the war, and she had a choice. She wasn't able to sell blended at the time because of prohibition, and she could either sell the company or she could start stockpiling, having family reserve. And I think it's these small decisions throughout the Macallan history that have made it into what it is today. She decided to start, you know, saving the barrels, having that family reserve. Next thing you know, that decision sold for $2.7 million. So yes, it's a lot. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable for a single bottle, but the history, the art, everything about it is pretty amazing. And for any monstrous whiskey collector that's able to spend that kind of money on a bottle like that, that's what they want. That is a talking piece for anybody that comes in. That is something that they can look at and just know, you know, this is from a barrel that's over 200 years old. It is amazing, but I understand the why. I guess being a whiskey lover myself, I do understand the why, and if I was able to do it, I would, without a question.
Yeah, that's the part that I'm torn by, Reed, is that if I could, a big part of me says that I would, but there's a little part of me that's like, dude, do you know what you could do with $2.7 million? I'm just,
It is ever so small and vanishing, that little part of you.
Yeah, you're right, man.
You're right. You know, it's the fact is that for some people, $2.7 million isn't a lot. And it's worth it to have that particular piece of history in their whiskey cabinet.
Yeah, I guess. What makes the Macallan special, in your view? It's the number one Scotch in the world in terms of sales. Is that right?
Single malt.
Single malt. Yeah. Sorry. Why is that? And what makes the brand so special in your view?
Well, there's a lot of things. I think what we're most proud of is our oak casks. Most people don't realize that we don't send our wood through the kiln. We actually air dry it. So whether it's in Ohio or for our American oak, or it's in north of Jerez for our European oak, we actually cut down the tree, lay it there to rest for a year, let it air dry, send it off to Jerez, the birthplace of sherry. We let it rest for another year. So before we even think about forming the barrel, it's been air dried for 2 years. We season it for about 16 months with dry Oloroso sherry. By the time that we're thinking about putting new make in there, it's already 3.5 years old. So the way that I look at, you know, the Macallan 12 is, yes, it's only 12 years old, but it's an accelerated 12 year because we didn't send it through the fire and we didn't close off those pores that give this natural color. I think what I was shocked at when I kind of dove in more and more and more into whiskey is how rare it is that there is no coloring added to a dram. And I know I already mentioned I already said that's organic before, but when you think about it, you go into a grocery store and you look at one apple and then you look at an organic apple. If you're choosing the organic apple, you know why you're choosing that. And I think that's what the whiskey lovers know and love about the Macallan, is that they're choosing organic. We are 100% of our color from the barrels, 85% of the flavor from the barrels. The other 15% is just a new make spirit. It is a natural, beautiful whiskey. As far as the company goes, you know, we're 200 years young this year. I say 200 years young because there's lots of stuff in the works. You know, we're looking at the next 200 years. We are the leaders in minimizing our green footprint. We're taking huge steps for that. We're finding ways to lighten our bottles so we can lighten our loads in the airplane. We have a phenomenal wildlife center on our distillery. We have the largest Scottish salmon run in Scotland. I think what I'm trying to say is that Macallan doesn't really cut corners at all. We never have, and we still don't, because we want to stay true to what Alexander Reed did 200 years ago when he founded the Macallan in 1824. We're also that beautiful luxury company. I say company, like, yes, we're a spirit, but we also pride ourselves on being a luxury company. And there's craftsmanship, there's hard work, and there's doing things the right way. And I think that's why Macallan is as successful as it is today.
And the concept of luxury when it comes to something like single malt scotch doesn't always automatically translate to price, but there are some Macallan scotches that, aside from the fine and rare 1926, are pretty hefty price. Is there a bit of romance in the pricing as well, or I guess just, you know, talk a little bit about the luxury aspect of the Macallan.
Yeah, we've kind of taken a step towards that luxury. Well, I don't want to say taken a step. We are in that step of a luxury company. You know, we only have so much that we can give out. We are in huge demand. I mean, if we wanted to, we could send everything off to Asia and it would be bought up instantly. Being in the Caribbean, we have a phenomenal allocation. We get stuff here that, you know, is really hard to find in the United States. There's only so much of it that can go around, and that definitely affects the price. And as I said, even though it's a 12 year, it is an extra 3.5 that we spend aging that wood properly. And that's a very, very monumental thing to consider, is that instead of aging it for those 3.5 years, we are just creating that wood properly.
So Reed, the last thing you said about things you can get here kind of triggered something in my memory. You were here in Nassau a couple of weeks ago, and you saw a bottle of the Macallan, and you bought it here.
That's correct.
I kind of wanted you to tell, you know, I guess tell that story as well, just to explain that what we have access to here, especially here in the Bahamas, is maybe something worth noting.
Yeah, absolutely. While I was there and I was in your awesome store, I saw the brand new Night on Earth, The Journey. The Journey is a awesome dram. Great price point as well. It's essentially based off of a beautiful human being in Asia. Her name is Nini Sum. She's a phenomenal artist, photographer, and we asked her to describe to us what New Year's Eve, which is Night on Earth, means to her. And it was being around her family, having rice pudding, watching the fireworks, and seeing these beautiful lights over her town. And that's essentially what we have done, and what we have put into the bottle, the packaging, everything about it is stunning. And the first time that I've actually seen it was in the Bahamas. I think you guys got it like a week before I got there, if that. And I, you know, I see this, I take photos of it, I send it back to my friends in the States, and they were so upset that I got it before them. Actually, I don't think they have it yet. So there is this level of clientele that comes to the Caribbean, whether it's on vacation or it's for work, and they can not only afford the Macallan, but they have an appreciation for the Macallan. And when they see something that they haven't seen in the States down here, it's a big desire for them to have it. Of course it is. You know, it worked on me, and it's an easy sell for me because I work for them and I love the product. But we are very, very lucky to have such things as the M series here. We have, I believe, a bottle of the Reach in Turks and Caicos right now. Don't quote me on that. Even 3 days ago, I did a training at a beautiful restaurant here called Mykonos. Mykonos had three fine and rares. They had the 1940, the 91, and the 90, and the 1990. And I'd never seen that before. And when I sent photos back to America, it was the same thing. They couldn't believe that I got to see these bottles, that I was doing a proper training on them, because you won't be able to find that easily in the States. My whiskey advocate friends, they had never seen those bottles before. So when they see those down here, I guess what I'm trying to say is that we're truly lucky to have the allocation that we have down here.
Yeah. All right. So Matthew, we are running up against the clock. So I want to give you the last couple of minutes to ask Reed or say anything to Reed that you wanted to say.
No, I'm just really happy. Thanks for coming on. Like I say, I've been just sitting here soaking up what I can, trying to age myself as what a fine whiskey in Sherry Oak. So just thanks Reed, it's very good to meet you.
Absolute pleasure, thank you for having me on. I've really enjoyed it. I'm very passionate about this. I love talking about it, so anytime that you guys want me back, I would love to, and there's tons to talk about.
Yeah, for sure. The question for our next get together, Reed, is the certified Scotch professionals, right? You are engaged in a process of earning a certification to, in 30 seconds, what is a certified Scotch professional?
So it's a course in Scotland. There's many different levels to it. The first level is what I'm doing. I have full intentions to carry on to the others. It starts off with the Scotch profession and the bourbon profession, then the whiskey master. And then there's a level two and a level three. Essentially what the CSP, the certified Scotch profession is diving into the back of house, the distilling part, the history, the different regions and the intense flavor profiles of all regions. The exam consists of blind tasting, written, verbal, a little bit of everything, multiple choice.
Hello?
As well. It's pretty intense, but I can't wait for it.
Excellent. Actually, when you were talking about it, I decided I in a year or so I probably try it out myself just because.
Fantastic.
I'm excited about it. Anyway,
absolutely.
The Parker Brothers ride again. Thank you very much for your time and energy. I appreciate you, man.
What a pleasure.
Yeah. The last sip for me of the Glenrothes 12-year-old Solera range is approaching, and I will toast to you both and say Dazdarovia.
Cheers.
Thank you so much. Absolute pleasure, gentlemen.
Yeah.